Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. This week, we're rerunning a show from last year around this time when we were rounding up all of our favorite cookbooks from the spring season. And, you know, I was just looking at them all again and they hold up. Great call, everyone. Good call, us. Great picks. Anyway, have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. This week, we are celebrating the cookbooks of this spring. There's a fantastic season of cookbooks being published right now, full of, you know, many different cuisines and cultural deep dives, personal stories, and just great recipes. I love this time of year because it's when publishers tend to release cookbooks from newer authors, or ones with more unique stories, or more specialized expertise, or all three. So today we've got interviews with authors of some of the books we're so excited about this spring. From The Glories of Arab Bread with Rima Seel and her book Arabia, to Jess Dammick's Pro Tips as a Salad Freak, to The Mexican Kitchen of Rick Martinez's Mi Cocina, and first, we'll start with Asma Khan. Her restaurant in London is called Darjeeling Express, and ever since she was profiled in the Netflix show Chef's Table, it has become a destination for food lovers from around the world. Like, her dining room is constantly filled with both chefs and movie stars. But her new book, Amu, Indian Home Cooking to Nourish Your Soul, is all about the dishes she learned at home from her mother. Hey, Asma, so good to have you back again.
Thank you very much for asking me back to come and speak to you.
Oh, no, I'm so excited. I'm so excited for your new book. It's beautiful. It's such a great read, and the food looks fantastic. And, you know, I was listening to our last conversation when you were on the show a few years ago, and, you know, you spoke so powerfully at that time about the fact that, you know, in the society where you grew up in India, you know, boy children were seen as the heirs, and that when you were born, your mother originally grieved because she wasn't expecting a daughter. So I love that you begin this book by saying that you are the heir to your mother's recipes, and that after that, you know, initial moment of disappointment, she made a point of treating you the same way as your brother. And, you know, that this book is an homage to your mother and the recipes that she taught you. So, like, how did it feel as you were reliving all these memories and writing this book?
It was extremely emotional. I wrote this book over the pandemic, and when we closed on the 17th of March, that date is etched in my soul. I remember closing and the world shut down. The world closed down in Europe. And then, for me, very frighteningly, the borders closed down. And I saw at that time, hearing stories about friends, parents who were passing away. My own school friend, she passed away. And within 40 days, three members of my mother's family passed away, three men. And I realized that there is this book in me. I need to set the score. I need to tell the world what I want to tell my mother, that she did it. She managed to bring equality in my life. She managed to teach me how, by standing, you know, shoulder to shoulder with another woman, you can lift them up, and in that way you rise. I wanted her to know all of this, and I just realized that this is it. Everything is gone. I'm in debilitating debt. I've got huge amounts of money I owe to my landlord. I cannot do anything. I have all these women who are now looking at me to look after them. I didn't know what to do, you know, to help
your
them.
Your staff, you mean?
Yeah, my staff.
Your team.
Yeah. Who couldn't go back to India. But then when COVID hit India, their households tripled because all the migrant laborers came back because all the cities shut down. So literally they told me, you know, now we have 30 mouths to feed. So I decided that I was going to find a way of raising money. So I did some work. I was able to support everybody. But then I knew I had to write this book And when I spoke to the publisher, they completely got it. They said, just write. I wrote the book before I did the recipes. And I wrote the book all night. It was endless. Because at that time, I needed to see dawn. I needed to see light break through dark. I needed to know day will come after night. That I will survive. I will make it through. My women will survive. Ammu will survive. I will see her again. The fear was so overwhelming. So when I started writing the book, it was this balm. It made me feel, even I'm getting emotional now, it made me feel that I'm now setting it down. I'm writing it. She's going to live. She's going to read this. I'm going to give this book to her as a way of acknowledging her contribution to my life. And it just was so easy to write. You know, literally, in my head, I divided this book into 5 decades of my life. And I started writing about each decade, each city where I was. And you can see that when you read the book, that, you know, I'm in Calcutta here, I'm in Hyderabad here, I'm in Madras, I've come back to Calcutta. And this kind of different stages of my life, I wrote everything that I thought was important. You know, the seasons, the weddings, leaving home, learning to cook. The recipes were in my head. I could just see them. I was visualizing me making them. I was visualizing eating them, watching the relentless rain. So I literally didn't even have to think that what was the recipe. The book wrote itself.
No, that's amazing. You know, that's such a gift. I've spoken to so many authors whose books are coming out now, and typically the way the publishing schedule works, if your book is coming out now, you probably were writing it during the pandemic. A lot of these books were started at this time in 2020. And obviously incredibly difficult and terrifying time. But I've spoken to so many authors who have said, you know, having the book was actually a salve, as you said. Like, writing a book is inherently an act of hope, right? It's inherently an act of the future. And so, I think it's remarkable to hear you say how that moment influenced you and sort of gave you this purpose and gave you this kind of strength to do this project and knowing that you were looking for the light, as you said. I want to get into the book, as you say, like, is structured through the course of your life. I love that structure. I love how narrative and biographical it is. There was something that caught my eye, and you just sort of mentioned it, the rains. When you were growing up in Calcutta, and the monsoon season would come, what is the food at that time? What is the seasonal food of that moment?
Well, it rains in England. But my God, the rain doesn't have that same magic. Because the first thing about the monsoons is the monsoons come after the earth is parched, after summer, where literally the soil is starved and the trees are absolutely waiting, the roots, for the rain. Then when it starts raining, the aroma from the earth, starting from there, to the birds coming out to bathe, the animals coming out to run around. You see that joy. And of course, then inevitably, because of the Victorian plumbing that Calcutta has, there's water logging everywhere. Then there's floods. And then the river banks break and the water's everywhere. The bazaars have to close. There's nowhere where you can get fresh vegetables. You cannot get meat. Everything shuts down. Mm-hmm. You are then stuck at home with whatever resources you have. And of course, you know, at that time, the power cuts go because all the grid is underwater. Mm. So you're sitting in the dark, there's no refrigeration, so you've got to eat whatever you can in the house. You know, a little bit of lentil, then you make pakoras. Pakoras are these, you know, deep fried, made with chickpea flour, with a little bit of onion, a little bit of something, potatoes. This is monsoon food. Mm. There's always enough tea. And the combination of sweet, spicy tea and a crunchy pakora in some chutney is forever. Even if I just smell that, I will look to see it's not raining. Why is there aroma of monsoon? That is monsoon fragrance. Oh, and of course, the other thing is even more heightened, because in India, you know, everybody keeps their windows open. So aromas are lost. In monsoon, because it's raining and you don't want your house flooded, all the windows are closed. And then the only thing that we could get that was fresh, which were eggs, because this is the time when this mafioso, the egg guys know that you can't go to the bazaar, so he's going to come to you and charge you a good money for the eggs. I mean, no one ever haggled with them because he would cycle through knee-deep water in his cycle, sometimes pulling the cycle along with his basket of eggs. And he would come to each house and we would wait for him. So in the beginning of the monsoons, I remember when the water just started getting stuck on the streets and the doorways, we used to have one egg. But towards the end, we would only have half an egg each because, you know, he would haggle. The prices had gone up a lot. And he often didn't have that much to give us. So it was just the eggs of monsoon, the pakoras. And it is also the time when I remember my father singing the ragas, the rhythms of rain. And if you hear it, if you just Google it, you know, the ragas of monsoon or of rain, you can close your eyes and imagine the water falling down. The beat is so beautiful. So I wanted to communicate that there is the seasonality in our food. There's a joy. And of course, you know, no school. That was the greatest joy because your school was flooded and, you know, and telephone lines down. So nobody could call you. Nobody could hassle you. And you sat around the whole day in your pajamas. Also, an additional thing, which I haven't said in the book, but I would love to say here, there is this thing about being dressed modestly in many families in Asia. You know, you don't sit around in your pajamas because somebody might come to visit.
Sure.
No one's going to come through that rain. So you knew you could stay in your pajamas all day because no one is going to come to see you. And that was also the great excitement, you know, just sitting around eating in your night clothes, not bothering because no one was going to come to see you.
You know, it's so funny because, you know, we just talked about the pandemic, right? Everyone was like locked in their home in a particular mode. It was a mode of fear. It was a mode of defensiveness, right? And what you're talking about now is such a beautiful, different idea. You weren't able to go outside, and actually it allowed you to focus on what was happening in your home. It allowed you to really enjoy it. It allowed you to feel comfortable and casual. And it brings you so much joy to hear that, thinking about how much we've had to stay home, not by choice, and struggling to learn how to appreciate it if we could.
And I remember one thing that, you know, what I used to watch in the monsoons was when the rain was slightly less, the birds would come out and dance in the puddles and bathe in the water. And then I remember in the pandemic, suddenly I could hear birds in central London. I live in Chelsea, very crowded road. And the tree outside my window had birds in central London. And they were beautiful. And unfortunately, now the traffic is back. All the buses are back. But during the silence, I saw them and I remembered that this is where you see how birds are so beautiful that they live so close to us. But if we don't watch them, we miss them.
Yeah. There's a lesson there. Thank you so much, Asma. This has been a joy to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Asma Khan is the author of Amu, Indian Home Cooking to Nourish Your Soul. She left us with a recipe for those onion fritters, Pyaz Ke Pakora. Find them at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Rick Martinez and his new book, Mi Cocina. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Okay, disclosure time. Rick Martinez's new book, Mi Cocina, Recipes and Rapture from My Kitchen in Mexico, is being published by the publisher I work for. That also means I got to see it as it was coming together, and I'm a little obsessed with it. Rick is the host of two hit internet video series, Sweet Heat and Pruébalo, and he's just this fantastic, warm, exuberant student of Mexican cuisine. Growing up in Austin, Texas, and not speaking Spanish in his home, he felt disconnected from his Mexican culture. And in 2019, he took the plunge, flew to Mexico City, bought a car, and drove 20,000 miles on the most epically delicious road trip. Rick, it's so good to see you.
Good to see you too, Francis.
So you were born and grew up a third-generation Texan.
Yes.
To a Mexican-American family, and you didn't actually speak Spanish growing up. And you start your book with this really interesting and poignant story about how you were watching Diana Kennedy on TV and remembered feeling a certain way about the fact that, you know, what was on TV was amazing and you were so excited about what you're seeing, but it was like also this like British woman who knew more than you did about your culture. Tell us about that feeling or that moment.
You know, I feel like I grew up shielded from a lot of our Mexican heritage and culture. We were, and it wasn't like we were hiding it because we were ashamed of it. My parents deliberately decided not to teach my brother or me Spanish because, you know, we grew up in Texas. I was going to say, you know, at a time, but I frankly think that the attitudes are still there, even, you know, 40 years later. But, you know, at that time, there was a fear that my parents thought we were going to be held back in school, we were going to be made fun of, that there would be consequences if we had an accent. And so the idea was English would be our only language. We would speak completely clearly and there'd be no question. There would be no problem at all. And, you know, and I think that was a wise decision on their part, but it had the effect of just insulating us. And, you know, our culture growing up was Texan. It was American. It was Tex-Mex. But we were labeled Mexican, and that wasn't a bad label to me. It was just, you know, people saw me, the color of my skin, and that was the label they assigned to us. But, you know, watching Diana Kennedy, it showed me this side of Mexico that I didn't know. I mean, not that I knew very much, but here was this woman walking the markets in Michoacán and buying all of this amazingly beautiful produce that I'd never seen before. Going and talking to the vendors, buying meats, cheeses, tortillas, and then preparing it in this kind of what seemed to me to be a sort of this magical kitchen. And I was just so intrigued by this. And, you know, and she, a British woman, was surrounded by people that looked like me. And yet I didn't know the language. I didn't know that culture, but that was the culture that people said that I belonged to. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to feel included in that because it looked so beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. And you actually write this other really interesting thing, which is you wrote that the desire to learn about this culture and to go to Mexico or return to Mexico was similar to you, in a sense, to the process of coming out. What do you mean by that?
I think a lot of people of color feel this way, but, you know, specifically me, I think you learn how to play this game that in order to get ahead, you need to hide your own feelings, hide your culture, hide anything that makes you different. I mean, most of my professional life, if not all of my life, I have been one of the only dark-skinned people in a room. Certainly when I started working in advertising and then later in food media, I would go into conference rooms and I was the only brown person, or I was certainly the only Mexican American. There might be a few other people of color present. And, you know, in order to get that story published, in order to get that video produced or sign that deal, you had to, you know, make things palatable to what was perceived as the general audience, which was always the white audience. So we were whitewashing our food. We were calling our food authentic to, you know, something. That would seem to be this magical marketing term that made people want to buy or watch or be a part of that content. And, you know, you end up hiding yourself. And it wasn't until I started researching this book that I found this feeling of being a part of something, right? I'd always been the one brown person. And then I came to a country where everyone looks like me, and all of those things that, you know, people had said over the years that were, you know, unique curiosities about me. So my passion, my love, like my energy. Now I was in a place where everybody had those same quirks, you know?
Yeah.
And I just felt so at ease and so comfortable being around people like myself that I didn't want to give it up. I didn't want to leave. And it just felt so comfortable that I felt like I could come out and just be me. And I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to be complicit in this whitewash game. I wasn't going to, you know, dumb down my food or, you know, take out what were considered the exotic ingredients because they might be scary to, you know, someone that may not know these ingredients.
Who just hadn't seen it before. Yeah.
Right. And once I did that, I not only felt more like me, the me that I'm supposed to be, the me that makes me happy. But I also found that people started enjoying my content and my writing, started pre-ordering the book more because I think they like this idea of someone being true to themselves as opposed to trying to be something that would sell to this, you know, mass audience.
Yeah. So your arrival in Mexico was a few years ago. You decided to dive head in. You flew to Mexico City. You bought a car. You drove to 156 different cities, towns, eating your way across the country, 20,000 miles. And you know, so this book is, you know, your love letter to the memories you made along that trip. But I do have to ask you this. Because of so much of your impression of Mexico was, you know, stuff you'd heard or stuff you'd seen, what surprised you about what you were eating specifically?
I think the diversity of it. I think, you know, I, like many Americans, you know, you grow up eating, you know, there are five sort of canon dishes in Mexican cuisine, according to most Americans. We just make different versions of enchiladas, tacos, burritos, and nachos, quesadillas. And certainly some of those are present in Mexican cuisine, but I think to me, the diversity of the food, and also regional differences. So, you know, and just like America is a very vast country that has, different geographies and climates and different things grow in different places, you go to, the southern part of the country and, there are parts that are very tropical. And so the fruits and the vegetables that grow there, the citrus, things are much brighter. So in the Yucatan, to me, it's just an intensely bright cuisine because of all the citrus. Mm. There are markets that are just dedicated to nothing but citrus, things that I'd never seen before. The fresh fish and seafood along the coast and aguachiles and ceviches, raw preparations. There are roasted preparations, grilled preparations. And as you move through the country, you see how different influences, the influences of immigrants, and not just European immigrants, but Lebanese, Chinese, Mennonites, and each place has a different cuisine that is built on the layers of all of the indigenous people that live there and the climate and the immigrants that settled in that area.
Yeah.
Like, for example, in the northern part of the country, you have a large Chinese-Mexican population during the 1800s in the United States. After the Chinese Expulsion Act, a lot of the Chinese immigrants that were building the railroads in the U.S. migrated south into Baja and settled in a city called Mexicali. And now Chinese Mexicans are making matcha flour tortillas with carne asada made with fermented bean paste. And
you know, that sounds incredible.
It was insane. It was insanely delicious. And you know, one of the most iconic tacos in the entire country, the Tacos al Pastor, is only in existence because of the Iraqi and Lebanese immigrants that came in from Veracruz and brought the trompo.
It blew my mind.
Brought shawarma.
Yeah. Grilled on a spit.
Right, right. But with pork.
Yeah, and shaved off into a tortilla. Rick, is there like one thing you would tell someone who's never been to Mexico? Like, what's the first thing they should taste when they arrive?
I would say, first, I think you need to go to Oaxaca. And while in Oaxaca, you need to sample the moles. Mole is an incredible mother sauce in Mexico. And there's so many different types of mole. You know, again, like every town, every state, every household has its own version of a mole. But they're so different here than they are in the U.S. And especially if you're, you know, used to buying them from a jar or getting them from a restaurant, you know, they can be very overly sweet or overly chocolatey, and that's not what a mole is. A mole is a very complex sauce, very similar to a curry, and with, you know, a lot of different ingredients. But a lot of those ingredients come directly from the region that you're sampling it in. So in Oaxaca, there are very specific chilies that grow in that state that are used to make these moles that are very difficult to reproduce anywhere else because it's difficult to source those ingredients. But it's so incredibly flavorful and delicious. And it was very difficult. I set out on a mission to try and find a bad mole while traveling through Oaxaca. And and it was a very unsuccessful mission. Even you know, stopping at a roadside stand on the highway, you still get these intensely beautiful moles. And it's because in order to cook it, I'm convinced that you have to do it from a place of love. You don't undertake this sauce because it's fun or because, you know, you have nothing better to cook. You know, this is it's a labor of love. And so to produce it, I just feel like, you know, I have recipes in the book of moles, and I've made them before. But I tell people, you know, this is the mole that you make at home, but you need to buy that ticket and go and try it for yourself.
That's awesome. I'm so excited to continue diving into this book, into the story, into your travels, Rick. And hopefully I'll see you in Mexico one day.
You need to come visit.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rick Martinez is the author of Mi Cocina, Recipes and Rapture from My Kitchen in Mexico. And he left us with a recipe for ceviche de camarón y leche de coco, which is a ceviche of shrimp with coconut milk. Find it at splendidtable.org. Reem Aseel isn't one of those chefs who always knew that she wanted to have a restaurant. She was a community organizer who was struggling with burnout, and she turned to food for comfort, not a career. But then she became more and more obsessed with bread, especially European-style sourdoughs, and then started to think, maybe I do want to work in food, and maybe in bread. And maybe do it in a way that celebrates her Arab heritage. And so Reem's California was born, casual bakery restaurant that's become itself the center of a community of fans, guests, and a family of strangers. Her new book is Arabia. Hey, Reem.
Hey, how's it going, Francis?
I'm so excited to talk with you today, and congratulations on your book. It looks terrific.
Thank you so much.
Something I'm so excited to get into with you about the book are the breads and all the things you do with bread. There are like a dozen recipes here, but they all pretty much start with, you know, like a foundational dough for Arab bread, which, you know, some of us know as pita. So let's start there. Describe what a great disc of Arab bread is like to you.
Arab bread is sort of the foundational piece of Arab cuisine. It's pretty much our vessel for everything that we eat. And so for me, a perfect piece or disc of Arab bread is one that is fluffy, slightly fluffy, has a good chew to it, has those beautiful, perfect sort of hints of char from an oven, preferably sort of a gas open fire oven or a wood fire. And I have to admit, you know, I judge a pita by the pocket. So
really?
Yeah, because you need to fill that thing. So, yeah. You know, unfortunately, too many variables related to bread. So then it's exciting. Every time you bake a piece of pita, is it going to pop up perfectly to get you that even pocket?
I'm fascinated by that. Is there a technique, or is it just in the dough composition? Or like, what are the techniques that you think about when you want to make sure it pops when you bake it?
That is... You want to get me into my nerdy baker science?
Time for nerdiness,
approach?
Yeah.
There's just too many variables. I think one is the fermentation. Is it at its peak where it's going to rise and react to the heat? The temperature of the oven, you want sort of the highest heat without burning it so that it pops and then it bakes through. You don't want just a... If it rises too fast, you're going to get that sort of thin crust on the top and a thick crust on the bottom.
Oh, interesting.
So you want it to rise ever so slowly. So you have to kind of hit that perfect mark for us, our pita at the restaurant, bake at about a 550 to 600. But it all depends on the weight of the dough and figuring out that perfect balance of the weight of the dough to the heat of the oven. But yeah, it's always like, oh, is it going to do it? I like to try to, you know, when we're in a rush at the restaurant, sometimes we don't allow that few minutes of proofing time, but that really helps, like letting the dough rest a little bit before it goes into the oven.
I'd never thought about that. I mean, I get why you want a hot oven because you need the heat to create that intense burst of steam that puffs up the bread, but I never thought about, well, if it's too hot, it can actually stretch it and balloon too much, so it's actually too thin. It's not that nice, fluffy texture.
Correct.
And then when you're rolling out the discs before you put them in the oven to bake, is there something you think about there to make sure you get a puff?
Yeah, I mean, you have to roll it evenly. You can't put more pressure on one part of the disc than the other, and that takes a little bit of technique. You don't want to overwork the dough. But yeah, if you're really good, you can do it sort of grandma style, tortilla style, where you just... sort of flipping it from hand to hand until it's the right thinness. Yeah.
And to do that perfectly even, that's like, that sounds like,
yeah,
that's some real
that's like
auntie
high
move.
Level.
That's like, you have been doing this for a long time.
Yes.
And okay. And so I want to get into your doughs too. You have basically have just two dough recipes, one yeasted and a sourdough. So, I mean, if I go to a store, like a typical store, I'm just buying a bag of pita. I imagine that's mostly yeasted.
Correct. Yeah, okay. I think there are very few people who are doing sourdough pita, which is sort of the Reams way. And this was something that sort of developed for me over time. I always sort of associated fermentation with the more European breads and the tartines and that sort of like wetter dough. I didn't think that my people were doing natural fermentation. And then it wasn't until I sort of did a lot more research to realize that actually... that's the only way people do it back home in the mountains, not in the cities, because of globalization and all of that. You know, the bakeries in the Arab world are doing more sort of quick yeasted breads. But I'll never forget somebody came into my restaurant and told me, oh, my God, your breads are like how they used to be in Lebanon, you know.
Oh,
and
cool.
So I just got immediately hooked and trying to really develop my sourdough. But then also realized that, you know, that sourdough takes a lot more time and a lot more care. And, you know, we had our moment in the pandemic where people were taking care of sourdough starters, but it wasn't necessarily practical or accessible to everybody. So I wanted to create a yeasted bread dough recipe that was as close to sort of the sourdough as I could.
We're talking to Reem Asil, author of the new book, Arabiya, Recipes from the Life of an Arab in Diaspora. We'll be back with more of her in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple
all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're celebrating the new cookbooks of spring, and right now we're talking with Reem Aseel, author of Arabiya. Let's start with your manayish, because it's what you're famous for at the restaurant. Tell us what that is.
Yes, the manouche, which is the singular version of manayish. I always say manouche is to manayish as goose is to geese. But it is the quintessential flatbread of what I would say the Levant, you know, so Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Jordan. It's what my parents grew up on. It's what, as a child of immigrants, sort of drove 30 minutes to the local Armenian-Lebanese bakery to get. And it's in its most basic form, it's a flatbread topped with a spice mix called za'atar, which is a wild thyme, sumac berry, and sesame seed mix. And we blend it with olive oil and then it gets slathered on this flatbread. And you can eat it folded on the go or open-faced and topped with fresh veggies. There's just so many ways that you can eat it. You basically can put anything and everything on it. I don't like to compare it to pizza. People say it's like the Arab pizza, but it's just... It's so much more distinct.
Yeah, that herbal flavor of the za'atar is
the herbal flavor. It's like seeped into the bread. It's, you know, depending on what country you go to and what village, everybody has a different thinness or thickness. Some are baked in the oven. Some are baked on asaj, which is sort of the traditional griddle that we have in the Arab world. But yeah, like manouche, this is just kind of a fun fact. The root of it, the root of the Arabic word is na'asha, which literally means to dimple and shape the dough.
Cool. Okay.
So it's just like that is the rite of passage of making a good manouche, is to sort of dimple that dough for all of the toppings to sit in it.
Oh, cool. And what are some of the other toppings aside from the za'atar?
Yeah, so we have cheese manouche, which is another sort of popular one. We use a cheese called akkawi, which is like a soft brine, salty cheese. Sausage, we do a sujuk, which is an Armenian sort of spiced cured sausage. You can put vegetables on it, anything that's in season. That's why it's fun. We, like, even at the restaurant, we kind of have fun with our seasonal manouche to reflect other cultures that we're a part of. So we like to have fun with it. But if you really sort of want to have a hearty manouche, it's typically topped with some sort of fresh component. So like tomatoes, cucumbers, and mint, or arugula. You know, at the restaurant, because we're in California, we put avocado on it to make it sort of that California touch. But you usually wrap it around these fresh components. So you got that sort of hot bite and chew, but then this, these sort of fresh veggies.
Oh, that sounds so good.
It's so good.
And, you know, there's so much more in this book. You know, it's not just a bread book. It's a really stunning cookbook on Arab foods from different cultures all across the Levant, like you said. But I wanted to dig into bread with you because, like, I know your food journey started there. And, you know, food was not always your career prior to that. So why is bread so important to you?
Yeah. Well, bread is sort of my connector to my roots in a way. It is the lifeline of Arab people. Like, even dating back to even before prehistoric times and the, like, Mesopotamia, like what is now modern day Iraq, that's like where bread originated. It was literally like how humans moved from hunters and gatherers to creators. And I always sort of had a, I don't know if it's like because my mom is a chemist or what it is, or maybe it's just in my blood or my roots, like always wanted to be an alchemist of some sort. So I always gravitated towards baking. I don't know. Bread is such a transcendent thing. Every culture has a component of bread, and it elicits these sort of indescribable feelings. Like everybody remembers the first time that they've like smelt bread or like walked into a bakery, that sort of.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to describe it, that like smell of yeast. And like, I just sort of connected all of it. And it was in 2010 when I actually went to Syria and Lebanon, when I walked into a bakery where I was going through really sort of, I was at a crossroads in my life. And that feeling came back to me of like my childhood. And I was like, this is the magic. And I like started to like see the bakers, and they were part of, they're like essentially extension of family. Like the baker is your uncle or your aunt, like they know everything about you and people coming in. And I just kind of yearned for that. I felt like I was lacking community and wanted to build that kind of community. So I was like, I want to be a baker, you know, not just be an alchemist of creating this beautiful thing that creates these like amazing feelings. Yeah. But I wanted to use it as sort of a tool to show people that my people are community builders, you know, at heart, especially sort of growing up as an Arab in diaspora here in the U.S. There's just so we're bombarded with a lot of anti-Arab sentiment, and wanted to kind of flip that up on its head. Right. And the way we show our hospitality and the way we build community is through our food. So that's kind of where I gravitated towards bread.
Yeah, totally. I mean, all of it is so powerful, right? Like you said, like the feeling of being able to create with your hands, but also this larger sense of, you know, the bread baker as the person who is the center of a community where people can be nourished is really, really powerful stuff.
And there's also just something to be said about the act of kneading dough. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was just like in my head a lot, and it was really sort of healing to be in my body. There is something to be said about being one with the dough. And over time, that's really what happened to me as a baker.
Thank you so much, Raheem. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Rima Seel is the author of Arabia, Recipes from the Life of an Arab in Diaspora. She left us with a recipe for her manaish, her signature flatbread topped with za'atar. Find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, so there are barbecue obsessives, ice cream addicts, pizza nuts, but it takes a special person to call themselves a salad freak. Well, Jess Damick is one such person. She's a longtime recipe developer and food stylist who's worked for years for the one and only Martha Stewart, and who is, in fact, the person that Martha entrusts with her salad making. Her terrific new book is called, you guessed it, Salad Freak. So hey, Jess, great to talk with you.
I'm so happy to be talking with you today.
Congratulations on the very exciting and inspiring book. And I say that with no hint of irony, but I know that there are people out there who are like, salad? Like,
you know,
you put lettuce in a bowl.
I really hope this book gets everyone excited about salads. I know I'm super enthusiastic, obviously, Salad Freak being the name of the book. You can see how obsessed I am. But I hope everyone who flips through it gets a little bit more excited, at least.
I think there's a lot to get excited about for salad. I mean, like, obviously, like, you know, for a lot of people, salad is literally like lettuce in a bowl with like dressing glopped on top and maybe a few like, you know, tasteless, you know, tomato slices or whatever. But as a personal veteran of the salad station, I know that a great salad is much more than it seems. So let me just start here. Like, what makes a great salad to you?
I think one of the things I love so much about salads is that there is such a great variety of texture. Mm-hmm. There's so many different opportunities for crunch. And also, I think my favorite flavor profile is bright, tangy, fresh foods. And obviously, that's, to me, what salads are all about.
Yeah. How did you become a salad freak?
I have to say, I think I owe it all to Martha Stewart. I mean, I grew up on the East End of Long Island, and I had the amazing luxury of farms all around me and access to fresh produce. So I think I've always been a little bit of a vegetable freak. But working for Martha, a big part of the job that I took on as a food editor was when she was in the office, I would make lunch for her. And a lot of the other food editors were like, you know, we had a lot of work to do. And then kind of the last thing they wanted was to add this huge stressful task onto their day. But as someone right out of culinary school, I was really excited for the challenge. So Martha would sometimes give a prompt, like, you know, her assistant would call down and say, oh, Martha's in the mood for something light, fresh, and truly delicious. Which I love that.
Not like fake
that.
Delicious.
No, truly.
Truly delicious.
And I love that. Like, what a good prompt. Yeah. And so it was always coming up with new combinations that were based off of exactly what was in season. Like, you know, the best looking peas at the market, or if the carrots were amazing that day. And it made me hyper attuned to these, you know, what was the best at that moment.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say, like, the gumption to be like, I'm going to cook for Martha. Let's do that every day. Like, that is incredible. But if you're, like, making a salad, where do you start?
I think for me, it really does start with the visual. You know, especially when I'm at the farmer's market, I just look at the produce and it's so beautiful. And I think slowing down for a second and actually really taking a minute to appreciate how amazing things that are growing out of the ground are, it just kind of tunes my whole brain to like what I'm about to do. I know sometimes we don't have the time for that, but I find just kind of tuning in to the beauty of what I'm eating just for a second really, really inspires me to cook.
Yeah.
And I look at shapes, I look at colors, and then of course I'm thinking about textures and flavors.
So what's an example of a salad that you love in the book, and like talk us through it?
Oh, it's so hard to pick. I think, you know, one of the most simple salads actually is a salad that's just snap peas and radishes with a little bit of lemon juice, olive oil, salt, and then a couple of pea blossoms. That salad came about because I had these amazing purple snow peas I was growing in my garden. And these are, you know, an example of something that like pop up in the farmer's market like 1 week during the spring, and they're so gorgeous. And I've never really known what to do with them because if you cook them, they completely lose their color. And I thought, okay, these are something I'm going to eat raw to keep that color. And to stay with that super fresh flavor, you know, what's something that can add to that, but not take away from that, that special, there's nothing else that tastes like a pea. It's such a unique flavor. And somebody else pointed out to me, there's like 6 recipes with peas in the book. So I obviously really love them. But to me, it's like the embodiment of spring. And I didn't want to take away from that. So I decided to add radish because radish has that really bright, peppery bite. And when it's sliced really, really thinly and put in an ice bath, it's going to add just a hint of that peppery flavor, but not be overpowering.
Sort of softens that flavor,
But by shocking it in the ice bath, it's going to crisp up and be like this really beautiful crunch. And if you are lucky enough to find them, there are purple daikon, which are a really, really beautiful, deep purple color that complement the purple of the peas so well. So obviously, we don't all have access to these crazy ingredients I'm talking about right now, but green peas are really beautiful and vibrant also. And I always am thinking about colors and shapes. So I love cutting the peas into matchsticks. So they're like nice little slivers and pieces. And then you have the beautiful rounds of radishes and it really looks stunning on the plate. But I'm talking about like 4 ingredients coming together to make this really amazing salad. And all it needs is that little bit of lemon juice for that little hit of acid and brightness. salt and just a drizzle of your, you know, the special olive oil you save for drizzling.
for this very moment.
Yes.
Yeah. There are also like certain little recipes throughout the book that you call secret weapons. It's like a sauce or a condiment or a little crunchy thing. What are some of your favorite little secret weapons?
One of the big secret weapons in my house lately has been chili crisp. I love a little bit of spice, and I've already talked about how much I love crunch. So this is combining the two. It's frizzled shallots and really crispy garlic cloves with some red pepper flake that also crisps up a bit. I put a little hint of cinnamon in mine as well. So addition to getting the heat, you're getting a little warmth. It's so amazing with root vegetables. I am like very happy like roasting a bunch of carrots and drizzling that on that and calling that a meal sometimes.
Oh, that sounds great. Awesome. And you know, actually, before I let you go, I want to ask you one more thing, because you talked about Martha earlier. And you've hung out with Martha, obviously, a lot, and also with her BFF Snoop Dogg. And you learned to make bacon from Snoop?
It's amazing what I've learned from Snoop. But I watched him cook bacon for the first time, and I was, like, startled. Uh-huh. It looked insane. He just sort of dumped the whole package into a pan, cranked the heat, and, like, stirred it with a wooden spoon. And when he took it...
That sounds like the kind of cooking move of someone who doesn't know how to cook.
Yeah, but somehow it made perfect, super crispy bacon that's like really curly.
Oh,
and
I love it.
We had a whole conversation about it, and I was like, Snoop, this is so genius. And he's like, yeah, I know. Have you tried it in a sandwich? And I was like, yeah, because this is how I cook my bacon now. It's ideal for a BLT or a breakfast sandwich because...
That curliness.
Yeah, it breaks off much more evenly instead of those sort of pointy shards that you get if you lay the bacon totally flat in the pan. So,
oh, I love it.
You can add sandwich engineer to Snoop's like long list of accomplishments.
Awesome. So the whole packet of bacon in like a frying pan and just stir the whole time.
Yeah.
Because when you say that at first, I'm like, oh, you're going to burn the stuff on the bottom and it's not going to cook. But if you're stirring the whole time, you're basically crisping it all over and it curls up while it's cooking.
Yeah. I think it's a real example of, you know, me like with my food styling background, overthinking things. You know, yeah. It takes someone who is not as familiar with everything in the kitchen to just simplify it and come up with a back to basics moment.
Yeah, it's actually perfect that way. I love it. All right, Jess, well, it's been a blast. Thank you and congratulations again.
It's been so much fun. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Jess Dammack is author of Salad Freak, and she left us with a recipe, yes, that uses peas. It's spring. Find her asparagus, peas, and cucumber cacio e pepe at splendidtable.org. God, it sounds good. Well, that's our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it, and please go out and buy some great cookbooks from a local bookstore if you can. There's so many good ones out there these days. Show them a little love, will you? Have a great week, everyone. Talk to you soon. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.